The 14th century was a period of transition. Little by little, the old feudal order was breaking down.
In France and England, the peasants were in revolt. The movement towards freedom from serfdom was on its way.
There was a new aggressive social group composed of merchants, bankers, master artisans and professional men. The middle class had arrived.
The current ideals were power, riches, earthly glory. Culture, previously limited to ecclesiastics, was now predominantly secular. The foundations of humanism were laid.
There was an increasing use of national languages instead of Latin. It was the era of Piers Plowman and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, of John Dunstable and the English School of Singing, of religious reformers Wycliffe and Huss, and a great upsurge of popular religious feeling.
Fashion, as always, reflected the times. In the wake of the plague, sudden wealth had come to many who made themselves conspicuous by wearing outlandish clothes.
In the East, the Sultan Bayezid, known as the Flash of Lightning, took an oath that he would not rest until the altar of St. Peter's had been transformed into a stall for his stallion.
For the papacy, there was a relief of the pressure from France, following on the English victories at Crecy and Poitiers. It was time to return home.
The first pope to return from the Avignon captivity was Urban V, and in June 1367 he took ship for Rome.
But Urban only stayed 3 years, returning to Avignon to die in 1370. During his Roman sojourn, he ordered a vast program of restoration, and from St. Peter's transferred the heads of the apostles, duly encased in silver, to the Lateran Palace.
Urban's successor, Gregory XI, although dominated by the cardinals, was not to be held in France. He realized that if the papal states were not to be lost forever, return to Rome was imperative. Even while he lingered, pressure was put on him by the Romans themselves, who sent an embassy, saying that if he did not come, they would elect another pope, by the anti-papal risings throughout the church states in Italy, and by the intervention of two women.
The first, Bridget of Sweden, was a visionary, and on Gregory's election, sent him a letter warning him of an early death if he didn't go to Rome. In her last vision, she saw the Pope tied to a rope, which on one side was being pulled by a multitude, on the other by God alone. And God was pulling in the direction of Rome.
The second woman was Catherine of Siena, who in a number of celebrated letters appealed to Gregory to delay no longer. In March 1376, she wrote,
"Most holy, sweet, and dearest Father in Christ, sweet Jesus, your wretched and unworthy daughter, Catherine, servant and slave of the servants of Jesus Christ, writes to you in his precious blood. Do not postpone your coming. Pay no heed to the devil. He knows he stands to lose and is doing his utmost to put obstacles in your way and rob you of what is yours by making you lose love and charity and preventing your coming. Come, I say, and do not wait for time, which does not wait for you. Show the manliness I expect from you. No more cowardice. Answer God's call to you to come and take possession of the place of the glorious shepherd St. Peter, whose vicar you still are, and then to raise the standard of the Holy Cross. So when this standard is raised, we shall be delivered from war, disputes, and iniquities, and the infidel people from their infidelity. In this way you will come, and then you will see the Holy Church reformed through the appointment of good pastors. You will restore to her the colour of glowing charity she has lost. So much blood has been sucked out of her by wicked gluttons that she has gone pale all over. But take courage and come, Father. Do not keep the servants of God waiting any longer."
When Catherine was in Avignon on an embassy from Florence, she met Pope Gregory and urged him to fulfil what he had promised. He was further encouraged by the fact that Rome had not risen against the papal governors. He decided to risk the journey back.
Money was short, and he had to pawn his jewels. But at dawn on January the 17th, Feast of the Chair of Peter, the Pope entered Rome, guarded by 2,000 mercenaries and acclaimed by frantically cheering crowds.
But behind all the triumph and excitement, Gregory had seen the reality. A ruined city, where the population huddled in squalor and misery. Adam of Usk, who lived in lodgings near the Vatican, wrote that he used to watch wolves and dogs fighting each other near St. Peter's. But the Lateran was uninhabitable. And so the Pope took up residence in the new Vatican Palace, which from then on became his official home.
Gregory died only 2 months after his return, and before he was buried, the people were out on the streets clamouring for an Italian Pope. Already in the Pope's last hours, deputations from many Italian cities had visited the cardinals in their residences to make the same request.
For the whole of the 9 days' mourning, the demonstrations went on. Tension mounted, and the cardinals went in fear of their lives. By now, the mob had blockaded all the roads out of the city and immobilized the boats on the Tiber. They even built bonfires, threatening to burn the cardinals if they didn't give the people what they wanted.
On the evening of April the 7th, as the bells sounded for Vespers, the cardinals entered the conclave. St. Peter's Square and the steps of the Basilica were solid with shouting, gesticulating Romans.
The cardinals took a day to decide. There were only 16 of them present, mostly foreigners, but they had a hard task. Of the 4 Italian cardinals, 2 were from rebellious cities, Florence and Milan, and of the 2 Romans, 1 was too old and the other too young. They compromised and chose someone who was neither a cardinal nor in Rome at the time of the conclave, the Archbishop of Bari, who had been Chancellor of the Papal Curia under Gregory and was also well known to the French element.
Meanwhile, outside, the people were growing impatient, and the cardinals were startled to see spears thrusting up through the floorboards of the room where they were sitting. And before they could do anything, the mob had forced its way past the troops guarding the entrance.
Afraid of the crowd's anger, the cardinals sought to distract their attention. They dressed up the old Roman cardinal in papal robes and sat him on the throne. As the exultant people prostrated themselves at the feet of the bewildered old man, the rest of the conclave took advantage of the diversion to make a hasty getaway.
When the old cardinal revealed the truth, the people were furious, but by this time the cardinals were safely in Castel Sant'Angelo or in the surrounding countryside. And the following day, the magistrates reminded the Romans that an Italian had been elected and they must be satisfied. On Easter Sunday, Urban VI was solemnly enthroned.